I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
Every member should support allowing the American people to hear the facts for themselves. That is really what this vote is about. What it's about, the truth. And what is at stake? What is at stake in all of this is nothing less than our democracy.
That was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi casting her vote yesterday to establish rules for the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. The full House vote was 232 to 196, with two Democrats voting with all the Republicans, who did not mince words, complaining more about the process than the substance of the inquiry. Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
Democrats are trying to impeach the president because they are scared they cannot defeat him at the ballot box. That's not my words. That's the words of my colleagues from the other side of the aisle that has offered impeachment three different times.
At issue are the revelations that President Trump pressured Ukrainian president to investigate Trump's political rivals, using almost $400 million in aid authorized by Congress as a carrot or a stick. This is the third time in U.S. history that the House has voted for an impeachment inquiry into a sitting president. We asked Jacqueline Thompson to join us. She's a reporter for the National Law Journal, and she's at the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. And Jacqueline Thompson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So since the House has already been conducting hearings for about a month, they've gotten a bunch of depositions as well. What's the significance of yesterday's vote?
Well, that vote was really to mark the impeachment inquiry's, start of the public phase of it. Frankly, they say they're going to start holding public hearings. This gives Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff the ability to hold those hearings and kind of lays out exactly what that process might look like, how they might release transcripts of closed-door interviews, how they might call in witnesses, and then eventually how it might be moved over to the House Judiciary Committee as they move forward with this impeachment inquiry.
Was there any requirement that they have yesterday's vote?
There wasn't. There was that court ruling that came out last week. Judge Beryl Howell said, this has been a legitimate impeachment inquiry, and there is no requirement that a vote be held, though it might help bolster their case. And, yesterday's vote, Democrats said this isn't us saying that we're authorizing the impeachment inquiry. We've already authorized by saying that it's happening. So yesterday's vote was more about procedures. But Republicans are really seizing on it to say, Democrats are trying to retroactively authorize an inquiry that's already been going on. And that simply isn't the case.
But what's interesting is the Republicans, until perhaps yesterday, were calling for this vote to be put before the entire House.
Yes. Back when they announced that, they said they wanted the House to have a vote on an impeachment resolution. The White House was very clear in saying that they wouldn't commit to cooperating even if such a vote was held. So this isn't necessarily surprising. Republicans have never been in support of impeachment or an impeachment inquiry. So the fact that they would then say, this now just proves that what has been happening was illegitimate is not entirely surprising.
Does this vote, though, give the House or give the leaders of the committee or even Stephen Schiff himself any more tools to get documents or to force testimony, things like that?
It really lays out more of the procedures that are at hand and really describes a bit more about exactly what they're going to be doing going forward. I think having this vote might help them in court. For example, one witness has gone to court to say, do I have to comply with this congressional subpoena for my testimony as part of the impeachment inquiry? And that may not be the only case. John Bolton has signaled that potentially that could be the same thing for him going down the line. So it could help them in that sense, but it doesn't necessarily empower them with additional authorities.
The last time there was an impeachment was the impeachment of President Bill Clinton back in the 1990s. From what you know about what was voted on yesterday, does that seem kind of in line with what happened in the 90s?
It does. But I think the big difference is that with Bill Clinton, the investigative part of that all happened with Ken Starr, the independent counsel. He spent years investigating Bill Clinton, investigating the associates, and it was very late into the investigation that the Monica Lewinsky allegations even surfaced for the first time. So they got all of the tools that they needed to impeach the president from that report. House Democrats don't necessarily have the same resources right now, which is why they're going through this current investigation and why it is that the House Intelligence Committee is starting to lead the charge at this point, and then it will go over to the House Judiciary Committee, which is the committee that traditionally handles impeachment procedures.
And again, that's Jacqueline Thompson, our guest for this first segment of Radio Time. She's a reporter for the National Law Journal. We called her up to talk about what happened in the House yesterday, the House voting to go ahead with this impeachment inquiry. And if you have any questions or comments, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. As I mentioned in my introduction, Jacqueline, this is really just the third time in U.S. history that the House has voted for an impeachment inquiry into a sitting president. Does the Constitution give the House, or even the public, to try to understand what's going on, any helpful guidance?
Not really. The Constitution is very, very sparse when it comes to impeachment. It basically says that the House has the sole authority to impeach the president, and that the Senate has the sole authority to remove them in the course of an impeachment proceeding, and that the Chief Justice will oversee the procedures. And that's really about it. And we know that it can be for bribery, treason, and high crimes and other misdemeanors. And then that definition alone is very broad. High crimes and misdemeanors. What does that mean? What constitutes a high crime or misdemeanor? So the Constitution does not give a lot of guidance. Past impeachments also can sets a bit of precedent, and it offers some lessons to lawmakers about how they might want to move on this going forward. But it also is a very flexible situation. Each impeachment proceeding has been done differently, and everyone basically gets to decide how they want to govern it this time around.
I mean, it seems that what's at issue here is this question about abuse of office or abuse of power, even things like corruption, and even things like betrayal. How do you see the House wrestling with those issues?
I think a lot of testimony has shown that there was pressure from the Trump administration in one form or another for Ukraine to open up this investigation into a political rival of the sitting president. And that is something that is very concerning for a lot of Democrats and, frankly, now a few Republicans. Yesterday, we had the NSC director for Ukraine, who is now going to be leaving his post, come in and say, there was this sort of consideration in terms of campaign finance laws, a potential violation there. But I don't necessarily think it's illegal. Well, something doesn't have to be illegal for a president to be impeached. It just has to reach a standard where lawmakers believe they can no longer have faith in that president to be able to carry out the duties of his office.
Well, and just to add to what you just said, so we've got the whistleblower report that came out earlier this summer, then the White House description of the conversation between the president and the president of Ukraine. You have the U.S. envoy to Ukraine, Taylor. You've got the fired ambassador to Ukraine testifying. You've got Mulvaney basically saying that quid pro quo is kind of, business as usual. There was testimony this week as well, someone who, decorated military veteran speaking as well. So it's interesting. There's this chorus of pretty much people telling the same story.
Yes. And, it's very striking that these witnesses have continued to come in after the White House has said that they're not going to cooperate with the impeachment inquiry in any form. And they've been directing these witnesses to not appear. And in response, Congress has been issuing subpoenas. And the witnesses, who are often active members of the administration, go ahead and comply with those subpoenas. That just shows you how strong the power of these congressional subpoenas is, and how strongly they feel about this and their need to go forward and speak about this. At the same time, a couple of Democrats have started to raise questions about the testimony that's been given to them, and they're concerned that perhaps witnesses have been, conferring with each other about what exactly they're going to be saying during these depositions, which is why Democrats had really wanted these proceedings to be private in the first place.
I mean, you're talking about leaks. I mean, there have been a lot of leaks from this testimony.
Well, not necessarily leaks, but more the fact whether or not witnesses are talking to each other before they go testify before the House.
Is there any evidence of that?
A couple of lawmakers have come out and said, I'm concerned because there seem to be some really striking overlap between some of these testimonies, and we have concerns about that. But You know, they haven't really spoken out much further on that end as exactly what those concerns are, but it's definitely something to keep in mind.
There is this question of quid pro quo, a kind of this for that agreement. And one of the arguments about quid pro quo was that even if the in a sense, the offer was made, the fact that Ukraine did not do the investigation into Joe Biden and his son kind of nullifies that. Can you straighten that out for us?
So Republicans are saying, you know, the fact that Ukraine didn't do that investigation means that the president didn't do anything wrong. Democrats say, well, the fact that the president made that ask in the first place is what is the criminal or at least improper misconduct by a president. And that is what we are most concerned about, the fact that he would even go ahead and make that suggestion. So whether or not Ukraine followed through doesn't really seem to be the issue here. And again, the Constitution is very broad in terms of what constitutes an impeachable offense. And Democrats, I think, really can make the argument that even just going to Ukraine and saying, hey, why don't you start looking into this guy, is enough to remove the president from office.
Kyle says, so the House passes articles of impeachment, the Senate tries and maybe acquits, an election is coming up, and maybe Trump wins again, then what? Which, I mean, if he is impeached in the House but acquitted in the Senate, he can still run for president, right?
Absolutely. You know, this is completely unprecedented in that this is the first time a president has faced an impeachment proceeding during his first term in office. With Nixon, it was his second term. Mm-hmm. With Clinton, it was his second term. They didn't have to run for re-election afterward. And, you know, some Republicans are saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't be holding impeachment proceedings so close to an election, to which Democrats are saying, are you kidding me? So it's definitely a totally uncharted territory, and there's totally that potential that the Senate could acquit him and that the president could claim that proves he is exonerated in this entire matter and use that to run for re-election.
Almost out of time here, Jacqueline, but you mentioned public hearings. They are coming. Do you have any idea of the timetable for that?
You know, they're hoping to get them done sooner rather than later. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of this month we're starting to see those hearings get called and those witnesses brought out to start talking publicly.
Interesting, looking at public opinion, which is kind of split when it comes to impeach and then remove, that it's about 47, 48 on either side of that issue. Do you think public hearings will move the public in one direction or another?
I think Democrats hope that public hearings will move public opinion, and that's why they want to have them, because they don't just have to make the case to the people that are going to be casting these votes, but they have to make the case to the American public.
We're going to leave it there. Jacqueline Thompson, thanks so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a reporter for the National Law Journal, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And sitting right next to her is our guest for the rest of the show, Richard Bell. He's got a new book. It's called Stolen, and it's subtitled Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. That's coming up next year on Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There's a missing persons notice written by distraught parents in Richard Bell's new book, Stolen, and it reads like this. Cornelius Sinclair, a colored boy, about 11 years old, left his friends yesterday, and as he had no cause and never before absented himself, it is feared he has been seduced away by some evil-minded person. Cornelius Sinclair was one of five black boys living in Philadelphia who were kidnapped by a violent gang in 1825 to be sold into slavery in the South. And while there was slavery in the North, Philadelphia was considered a city where black residents had some modicum of freedom, although the threat of being abducted was real. Richard Bell tells this extraordinary story in his new book and calls what happened to these children a reverse Underground Railroad. He says that hundreds, maybe thousands of freed blacks living in the North were its victims. Richard Bell is an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland, joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And thanks for writing this book. I learned so much. But let's set the stage. Philadelphia in 1825 had the largest black population in the country. What was it like for black residents to live in Philadelphia at that time?
It was a mixed blessing. Legally speaking, many of the large, dynamic members of the free black community in Philadelphia enjoyed legal liberties that were not common in other parts of the United States, especially in the slave South. And the population was large enough that they could live in communities surrounded by people that looked like them and knew their histories and families and cultures. But at the same time, Philadelphia, for all its vaunted reputation as the city of brotherly love in the 19th century and as the headquarters of America's fledgling anti-slavery movement, was still a very difficult and arguably a very dangerous place to be free and black in the United States. That had a lot to do with ongoing racial prejudice and racial tension in the city in the 1820s. Philadelphia was coming out of a major economic recession caused by the Panic of 1819, which meant that jobs were tight, jobs were scarce. There was enormous labor competition, job competition in the Philadelphia labor market, which meant that free African-American women and men most particularly, really struggled to find gainful employment. And for those children in their households who needed to work to support the family household budget, those opportunities were constricted and contracted as well. We see all sorts of housing discrimination in this period as well. We see white-on-black street violence in this period. There are all sorts of, you know, you would call them macroaggressions or terrorist attacks against free black churches and other community organizations. So it's a very difficult place to be free and black, number one. And number two, kidnappers are everywhere.
Well, and kidnappers were everywhere. It was something that parents had to be on the lookout for. And I remember reading the story of Solomon Northrup. He was the adult black male who was kidnapped and sent to the South into slavery. But you write that in many ways it was children who were the target of these kidnappers. Children because they could be easily, kind of using the language of that that poster, easily seduced.
That's right, yeah. So I love the memoir, 12 Years a Slave. It's such an important piece of anti-slavery literature written by Solomon Northup after he is kidnapped into slavery, endures 12 years as a slave, and then escapes and writes about it. Yeah. But as a literate adult from a prosperous middle-class background in upstate New York, it turns out that his experience of being kidnapped and trafficked into slavery in the 19th century is somewhat unusual. Vastly more common, at least, was the kidnapping and human trafficking into slavery of children, particularly under the age of 16. And my book focuses on five boys, the oldest of whom is 15, the youngest of whom is 8, who are kidnapped over the space of about 24 hours. And that's for exactly the reasons you said, Marty, that professional kidnappers see them as easier marks, easier to gull, to seduce, to lure away, to decoy, to gather in their arms, to stick a black gag in their mouths, to carry them away by force if necessary. Adults have been on guard for years for kidnappers, and they have trouble getting their children to take that threat as seriously as they need to.
Well, let's name some names. These are the five boys. Enos Tillman was about 10 years old. Alex Manlove was 8. Joe Johnson, 14 or 15 years old. Cornelius Sinclair was 10 years old. And Sam Scomp was 15 years old. Now, he was a runaway from a plantation in New Jersey who was in Philadelphia at the time. Tell us, though, about this gang, I don't know, or really a group of terrorists, to really put it in our language that we use today, run by this guy named Joseph Johnson. Tell us how they did what they did.
Yes, these people are despicable. I came to this kidnapping via some records about one of the kidnappers who was eventually tried for murder and then died in jail. This is the most fearsome gang of kidnappers, child snatchers, and human traffickers in early 19th century America. And they operate out of a pair of safe houses down on the Delmarva Peninsula, right on the state line between Maryland and Delaware, and they run, let's say, missions or hunting trips into Philadelphia to try to grab as many people as they can, as quickly as they can, and spirit them back out to the peninsula, and then try to carry them across the Chesapeake Bay and then across the entire country to sell them into the Deep South, which is the whole purpose of this operation. And this gang, which I call the Cannon Johnson Gang, after its two leaders, Joseph Johnson and his mother-in-law, Patty Cannon, it's a gang of outlaws, obviously, because kidnapping is illegal in all of these states. But it's also a gang of in-laws. They're all related to each other by marriage, by blood. It's a family affair. It's a family operation. You can think of it maybe in terms of a mafia family or something like that. And they've been at this game, which is not a game, of course. They've been at this game for 10, 15 years by the time that these five individuals, these five boys, fall into their clutches in 1825. And they've got very good at their business. They are highly skilled, deplorable professionals.
Well, you also write about a guy named John Purnell, who was a mixed-race kidnapper. And why would someone who was mixed-race get tangled up with this group?
Yes, this finding that some of the frontline operatives that this gang employed were black or mixed race, this startled me and shook me to my core when I came across this. I was not expecting to find people who were non-white involved in the kidnapping of free black children into slavery. But one of this gang, the Cannon Johnson Gang's most peculiarly effective and, again, deplorable innovations is its decision to try to bribe, pay, hire a small number of black and mixed race adults who live in Philadelphia or its environs to do the kidnapping, to do the lying, to do the persuading, to do the luring, the spiriting away. The gang sees obvious advantages in having someone who is dark-complexioned sidle up to a dark-complexioned boy and offer them 25 cents to help them unload some peaches and watermelons from a nearby ship. If you follow me this way, I'll give you some money. You look hungry. Wouldn't you like a job? There's an element of playing on a sense of common racial identity and loyalty there, which these kidnappers viciously exploit. And the people they hire to do this work, I can't speculate about their motives beyond the fact to say they are paid handsomely. One of these kidnappers, John Purnell, the mixed-race man who does lure away these five boys at the center of my book, he later brags that he earned between $50 and $100 a week doing this work. And this is at a time when most free black men, if they were lucky, would earn $15 a week. So the sad truth is that money talks.
And that is Richard Bell, our guest on Radio Times today. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland, and he's got a brand new book we're talking about. It's called Stolen, and it's subtitled Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home, obviously involving Philadelphia in many ways. You can join our conversation. Any questions or comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. But here are these five boys. They are kidnapped in Philadelphia. They're put on a ship in the port of Philadelphia. It seems to me a lot of people had to look the other way in order for them to essentially be kidnapped.
Yes, I think that's right, Marty. I think there are people looking the other way at every stage of this story, which tells you a lot about, again, the racial tensions within the United States in the 1820s, not just within the slave South, where the second half of this book takes place, but also in somewhere we often characterize as the free North, as if living in Philadelphia in the 1820s is a land of milk and honey. As I show the lives of these children before they are kidnapped and the lives of their parents and their families are lives marked by ambition, but also over by struggle and opposition and prejudice. And it is not the case that the city or state government is a natural ally for free black people yet in the 1820s. Likewise, there is an anti-slavery movement beginning to build momentum in Philadelphia by the 1820s, but it is a small a minority position. It's a fairly radical position to be anti-slavery and consider yourself an activist on behalf of free black people when free black people are the victims of considerable stigma, as I've mentioned. There are also continuing schemes, we call them colonization schemes, to try to deport, to export free black people out of places like Philadelphia and Baltimore and elsewhere and send them to Africa, send them to Liberia, send them to Haiti, send them anywhere but here, that the solution to America's racial problems is not racial equality, that it is deportation. And that movement is popular.
You mentioned the Delmarva Peninsula, and you quote Frederick Douglass, who described this part of America at the time, and again, where Delaware and Maryland come together, rather close to Pennsylvania. And Frederick Douglass writes, where slavery, wrapped in its own congenial midnight darkness, can and does develop with all its malign and shocking characteristics, where it can be indecent without shame, cruel without shuddering, and murderous without apprehension or fear of exposure. We're very familiar with the Underground Railroad and Harriet Tubman. I believe the movie comes out today. But you describe this as really a reverse Underground Railroad. And do we know how many people were, like these five boys, kidnapped and sent back into the South?
Yes, it's always good to hear from Frederick Douglass, who always speaks so powerfully about these things.
He does.
And I'm looking forward to going see the movie later today, the new Harriet Tubman movie. So, yes, I refer to the phenomenon of kidnapping and human trafficking into slavery in this period as the reverse Underground Railroad. And that's not a perfect comparison, of course. Sometimes it flattens some distinctiveness. But there is a lot of parallels to be drawn, I think. In one way, the kidnapping into slavery is a mirror image of freedom seekers trying to exit slavery. The direction of travel is parallel but different from the south to the north in the case of the Underground Railroad, from the north to the south primarily in the case of what I call the reverse Underground Railroad. And the parallels don't end there, right? In both networks, we're talking about close circles of trusted participants who rely on secrecy, who rely on disguise, on forged identities and false papers, and so on and so forth. As to the scale, I should say that historians can make have made informed estimates as to the size of the Underground Railroad. But anyone who tells you that they know exactly how many people took advantage of the Underground Railroad or exactly how many freedom seekers successfully exited slavery in the 19th century is not perhaps being forthright. We have to speculate about this. We have to use different bodies of sources and sort of use our best judgment when it comes to the Underground Railroad. And the same is true for the reverse Underground Railroad for obvious reasons, right? Just as Harriet Tubman is a lawbreaker in the eyes of the slave South, so too are kidnappers in the eyes of the state of Pennsylvania and, of course, the free black communities they prey on. So we do not have accurate statistics which we can point to and say, aha, this is how big the Underground Railroad definitely was. This is how big the reverse Underground Railroad definitely was. But if you do look at missing persons notices, if you look at fugitive slave ads, if you look at newspaper accounts, and if you read hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of these things, as many scholars, including myself, have done, then you walk away very comfortable with the idea that these two networks, the Underground Railroad and what I call the Reverse Underground Railroad, were roughly the same size, which is to say, over 50 or 60 years in the early 19th century, we're talking about thousands, if not tens of thousands of people traveling in each direction.
And I think we're more familiar with the international slave trade, the slaves who were, or the Africans who were enslaved and brought across the ocean to America, and probably less familiar with the domestic slave trade and the kind of, you know, we shouldn't be shocked by this, but the kind of misery of what it was to be chained and force marched from one part of America to another.
That's right. So this thing, the domestic slave trade, this is a major migration in 19th century America after the closing of the transatlantic slave trade, after 1808, when it becomes illegal for Americans to continue to import black people as slaves from Africa or the Caribbean. What takes over to supply enslaved people to new territories and states rising up in the Southwest, like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, what takes over is the legal domestic slave trade, whereby slave owners in places like Virginia and Maryland decide to sell a certain number of their enslaved laborers to slave traders, who then either ship them to the Gulf Coast or march them across the country. And this domestic slave trade, entirely legal, to be clear, accounts for the forced migration of about 1 million people, black people, between 1790 and 1860. And this reverse Underground Railroad is a parasite on the side of that legal domestic slave trade. The kidnappers I write about are trying to take free people and pass them off as legally purchased slaves and sell them into slavery at great profit in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama. And I estimate that their traffic accounted for about 4 or 5% of the much larger and entirely legal domestic slave trade.
We're almost about a break here, but I mean, this is terrorism. I mean, obviously, slavery in itself is terrorism, but the fact that you could take someone who was free and then force them into slavery.
That's right. And of course, the people who understood just how traumatic and terroristic this was were the people targeted by this these kidnappers. Right. So the five free boys at the center of my story resist their kidnappers in multiple different ways, sometimes at great potential for personal sacrifice and danger to do so. And, of course, their parents try to do everything they can to get their children back. You began this segment, Marty, by reading out one of the boy's father's missing persons notice. And yes, and he says, you know, if you can send any if you see my boy anywhere, send us information, because me and his mother, we are afflicted. That word afflicted jumps out at me every time I read that. And could there be more of an understatement for having your children snatched away from you?
Well, and something to think about in our current day as well. Richard Bell is our guest. He's got a new book. It's called Stolen. And again, subtitled Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. We're going to talk more about what happened to these boys, these five free boys who were living in Philadelphia when they were kidnapped, after this very short break. And again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In 1825, five free black boys were kidnapped in Philadelphia, smuggled into slavery in the South. Our guest historian Richard Bell tells their extraordinary story of the story of their kidnapping, the efforts to rescue them, their attempts at escape, attempts at justice, and again, his new book is called Stolen. One of these boys, Sam Scomp, as I mentioned earlier, and as you write, was a runaway actually from a plantation in New Jersey. He was about 15 years old. He is beaten within really what seems like an inch of his life, and then sold to a Mississippi plantation owner, a man named John Hamilton. Sam Scomp tells Hamilton about being kidnapped. Hamilton then sues the kidnapper, and the question that just hangs out is, how do you explain why a slave owner who buys a slave would then sue the kidnapper for mistreatment?
Yeah, so this is one of the questions that motivated me to write this book, because there were all sorts of unusual elements and, I guess, twists would be the way to say it, in this particular story, which made it unlike the story of so many other free black children and adults kidnapped into slavery in this period. In some ways, the story is very similar and representative of the larger whole, the larger phenomenon, but in other ways, there are certain things which are unusual and different, and one of these things that demanded an explanation, I thought, was why, when a free black child who's been kidnapped into slavery tries to blow the whistle and chooses his potential buyer in Mississippi as the person he wants to blow the whistle loudest to, why that potential buyer would listen, would care. I think we carry with us very vivid ideas in our heads about who Mississippi slaveholders were in the 1820s and the early 19th century. And yet the actions of this particular Mississippi slaveholder seem to confound those expectations. And it's not, to be clear, it's not because Sam Scomp has suddenly found the only good, virtuous owner of human beings in America to blow the whistle to. It's not that at all, of course. It's because there are certain personal, political, and economic reasons why Mississippi slave owners do not want to be seen to be encouraging the kidnapping of free black people from northern cities. As I write in the book, there's a surprising alliance of people in political authority in Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana, who, when called upon to act to return some of these boys to Philadelphia, and when they're called upon by the mayor of Philadelphia to lend this assistance to him, are willing to comply. And that has a lot to do with the very dicey reputation of places like Mississippi as places to migrate to, as places to invest in, as places that were developing reputations for being fairly lawless and unregulated. And yet these new states, these new territories and states need people. They need white settlers. They need a massive investment from Philadelphia banks and businesses if they're going to thrive, grow, and prosper. And so fundamentally, and there's a lot more to it that I won't say here, it is bad for business to be seen to be trafficking in free black children. And when they're called out on it, they have a decision to make about how to respond.
I mean, the idea is that we're going to do slavery the legal way, not the illegal way.
We are going to be seen to do slavery the legal way.
Well, this John Hamilton, I mean, does hire a lawyer. Again, I'm John Henderson, and you mentioned the mayor of Philadelphia was Joseph Watson. He was a Quaker at the time. And it seems between the lawyer and the mayor of Philadelphia at the time, the wheels of justice begin to turn slowly.
They do, yes. Yeah. So the mayor of Philadelphia does become involved when he's informed of the disappearance by Hamilton's lawyer, John Henderson. The mayor of Philadelphia gets a letter out of the blue in early 1826, and it's not clear how much the mayor of Philadelphia knew about the boy's disappearance when it had happened 6 months earlier. His recollections, in print at least, in his surviving papers, are a bit conflicting. It seems he was aware that he'd heard it either in the newspapers or more likely from parents coming to his office and telling him when it had actually happened. But at the time, he'd not done much. But now he's called to action by a lawyer from Mississippi who writes to him at great length about the the boys which are now in his custody, and the mayor again has a decision to make. And I'm going to ignore this letter, or am I going to do something? And to be honest, if it had been the previous mayor of Philadelphia or the subsequent mayor of Philadelphia, it's really not clear that these boys would have received the material and legal and political assistance which they do in fact get from this mayor of Philadelphia, Joseph Watson, who serves, I think, 4 one-year terms from 1824 to 1828, and that has a lot to do with his Quaker background, I think. It has a lot to do with his personal beliefs, his private life, and his previous investments in helping homeless indigent children in Philadelphia. This is someone who'd made it one of his signature political acts in his public career to help street kids. And there, in 1826, comes along an opportunity to help five street kids from his city who are in acute need of help. And on this particular occasion, the mayor steps up, and the ways he does so are really, I think, extraordinary. I think readers will be impressed and surprised by just how much work goes into the effort to try to rescue and rendition these boys.
Indeed. Well, Cornelius Sinclair, this young boy whose parents put that, in a sense, that wanted poster out for him, he actually goes to court to argue about, to argue his case, to say, I am a free person.
That's right. And his
story,
which
is extraordinary when you think about, in a sense, a child doing that.
Absolutely. It's not unprecedented, but it's close to unprecedented, Marty. When we think of what we call freedom suits, which is black people who think they have a legal case for their freedom going to southern courts in southern slave states and going before white judges, white juries, taking on white lawyers and white slave owners who owned them in court, we think of that happening rarely for all the obvious reasons. And we also think of adults and typically men doing this. But the sources tell us a different story. And in this case, Cornelius, with the help of two white Methodist ministers in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, who take a strong interest in his particular case, because he ends up in Alabama, whereas the other boys end up in Mississippi, they do stage a freedom suit, and they persuade, again, white judges and juries to endorse Cornelius's freedom claim. Now, your listeners might be thinking, well, of course they would, right? He must have a watertight claim to freedom. And on paper, that's true, right? That he's telling the truth, that he was legally kidnapped into slavery and therefore should be freed. But the way the southern courts work, they all have allowances for people who believe they've been wrongfully taken into slavery to try their case. But in practice, people who do rarely win. And that's because the legal codes in southern states like Alabama say, well, we can't take your word for it that you're free. We need some white people who knew you when you were free.
Of course.
We need you you need those people to come down from Philadelphia to Alabama at their own expense and stay here for 3 months while they give trial testimony, etc., etc. And that's an extraordinary ask for what at the time is a 10, 11-year-old boy to be able to engineer credible white witnesses to miraculously appear at the right place at the right time. In fact, he needs the help of the mayor of Philadelphia to make that happen. And even the mayor of Philadelphia really struggles to find people who did know Cornelius, who are white and who are respectable and who are willing to go down there to testify. And kidnappers know this. They know that if they can smuggle a child into domestic slavery, if they can get them from Philadelphia to Mississippi, Alabama, then the chances of a credible white witness ever coming down there to assist in their exit from slavery are very low indeed. In fact, we have several commentaries at the time complaining about just how difficult it is to ever win a freedom suit for a kidnapped child, not least because children kidnapped when they're 10, 11, 12, Marty, they look different 2 years later. And credible white witnesses go down there and they do not always recognize the child they knew 2 years ago.
Well, the subtitle of your book is "And Their Astonishing Odyssey Home." So although one is killed, is that correct?
One of the five boys is
murdered by one of the kidnappers.
That's right. He's beaten to death.
And the four do go back to Philadelphia. Do we know what happened to them? How they were able to live out their lives?
There's some things I don't want to say on the radio about what happens to the boys. I want readers to pursue that story for themselves. But one thing I will say is that their story changes lots of things. Their story matters in various important ways. But the boys who do return to Philadelphia, their priority is to live their lives. They do give testimony, important testimony, damning testimony in Philadelphia courts about the people who kidnapped them. And you could argue that the subsequent manhunt for those kidnappers, which is enormous and wide-ranging, by the way, could not and would not have taken place without the damning testimony of these boys, where they describe with astonishing powers of recall the physical features of every kidnapper they ever met, how tall they were, what scars they had, that sort of thing, which is tremendously helpful to the mayor and his high constable. But they also go back to living their lives. They reunite with their families. Now, their families have had to deal with extraordinary amounts of grief and trauma during the boy's absence, and I try to spend as much time with the families during the boy's absence as I do with the boys themselves, and not everyone in the family is able to process that that grief and trauma successfully. But when the boys return, they do reintegrate into the free black community in important, nourishing ways. And there's some question as to whether we can see their shadows in the membership roles of subsequent, you know, vigilance committees and anti-slavery activist networks going forward. You know, the records are so spotty that it's hard to say for sure that these people grow up to join in the anti-slavery fight. But to be clear, they've already played a major role in the anti-slavery fight in everything they've done to win their freedom.
Any of the kidnappers ever brought to justice?
Yes. Yes, they are. So I mentioned this manhunt, and it's extraordinary, right? I think it may be the nation's largest manhunt up to that point, certainly one of the largest manhunts. It takes Philadelphia's high constable, you could think of him as like the chief of police. It takes him as far afield as Mississippi and Alabama, Louisiana. And it also takes him as far north as Boston in hot pursuit, literally in hot pursuit of one of the kidnappers. In fact, the mayor and his team succeed in arresting several of these kidnappers and human traffickers, bringing them to trial, and they are, in fact, sentenced to considerable prison terms. One of the amazing source discoveries I made in the course of, I think it was 6 years of research in, 35 different archives in 14 states, was I was able to discover two handwritten letters to the governor of the state of Pennsylvania by two of the kidnappers who had, in fact, been sentenced, convicted, incarcerated for their crimes, begging for clemency, begging for mercy, begging for a shorter sentence. And to hear, even in these just two letters, the kidnappers speak in their own words and their own voices about what they'd done and what they thought their responsibility was extraordinary for me.
Well, we have a couple minutes here, but there's some interesting laws that get passed. Pennsylvania passes a tough law having to do with people stealing free black people out of Pennsylvania. That Pennsylvania law is struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. And then in 1850, we have the Fugitive Slave Act, basically saying that if there's a fugitive slave, they can be, you know, the slave owner or the people that they hire can go into Pennsylvania or other states and bring them back to slavery. And that, in a way, opens the door for the Civil War.
That's right, Marty. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this story of these five boys is actually the cause of the Civil War and it's been hiding in plain sight and I'm the first person to discover it. That's not the case at all. But what I would say is that the furore surrounding this particular kidnapping case is a major contributor to an 1826 personal liberty law passed in Pennsylvania designed to deter kidnappers from doing this sort of thing again. That law is challenged in court, as you said, in versus Pennsylvania in the Supreme Court in 1842. Southern slaveholders are enraged by these personal liberty laws, and it ends up informing the passage of the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, which I argue is a sort of pro-slavery abomination that sets this country on a collision course with Civil War a decade later. And the terms of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act are thus that while on paper it is designed to protect the property rights of Southern slaveholders whose slaves abscond in search of freedom, what it also effectively does is provide legal cover for kidnappers to steal legally free people pretty much with impunity. The odds are stacked against free people after 1850 in a way that had not quite been the case before 1850. So we see kidnappers start to operate much more brazenly, basically in the open, after 1850. There's no longer any need to persuade, decoy, lure people away, or hire free black operatives to do that terrible work for you. You can do it in broad daylight. Take yourself before a federal judge and get a piece of paper saying the person you have with you is a runaway slave, and then go about your business.
Well, Richard Bell, we could go on, but we have to end our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for writing this book as well.
I appreciate it, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Associate Professor of History at the University of Maryland, Richard Bell, is the author of a new book called Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us.